Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm Mona, and I was married for 30 years, in that relationship for 32, and we didn't find out until our 29th year of marriage that we were a neurodiverse couple. I've been divorced for about 5 years now, and we have an amazing adult daughter who's thriving and doing fantastic. And today I am so excited to bring back Greg Fuqua. And Greg was a guest in season 4, and we had such an amazing conversation. I asked him to come back and be a guest co-host for season 5. So Greg, welcome to your first co-host episode of the podcast.
Thank you so much. Yep. So I'm Greg Fuqua. I've been in a neurodiverse relationship for 32 years, still in that relationship. I also have 2 kids, one that's transgender and on the spectrum, and one that's non-binary and ADHD. I was self-identified at age 49. I am a autism spectrum, quote unquote, disorder clinical specialist and a neurodiverse couple therapist and a licensed mental health counselor in Iowa. So happy to be here.
Oh, I'm so glad to have you back. We're going to have great conversations, I know, every time we get together. And I'd like to share with the listeners a little bit about what we're going to talk about today so they can be prepared for the great conversation. So we want to start with talking about kind of unidentified autism and awareness and understanding around that. And then we're going to talk a little bit about recognizing and normalizing autism spectrum. And then we're also going to talk about the generation gap and some of the things that Greg has kind of brought to my attention, like narcissism and control issues and some of the overlapping traits that he or others he's worked with may have experienced. So we're going to start with the big kind of elephant in the room, Greg, okay. The unidentified autism. And just to kind of kick us off, I know, you know, I say this at the beginning of every podcast, that my ex and I did not know that we were a neurodiverse couple for the first 29 years of our marriage. So all these challenges we had around communication, about emotional differences, about sensory sensitivities, you name it, that were causing conflict and were creating anger and resentment and leading to meltdowns and shutdowns, then we had an answer. You know, we had an answer, but unfortunately for us, it was a little too late. So do you want to start maybe by talking about how unidentified autism maybe has played out with some of the clients you've worked with or in your own personal life?
Oh, yeah. This is an important thing. I mean, obviously, it's very hard to work on your relationship and a neurodiverse relationship without identifying your neurotype. Yeah. So, and, you know, my story's really so similar to yours in that it took about 29 years for my wife to figure it out. It took me another year or two for me to come to it on my own. But yeah, for sure, once she sort of recognized it, which she kind of discovered with her own therapist, the relationship immediately got better. And we had a place to sort of work from. But yeah, this is a big deal, I think. And I guess a way of starting to talk about this is to recognize what has happened in terms of autism prevalence rates, which have been dramatically increasing. And so if we think, you know, about some 20 years ago, it was about 1 in 1,000, and this is right, kids. Now we're at about 1 in 44. And so you have to think about that for a second and how we need to sort of catch up with our understanding of the diversity of how autism expresses itself and even its subtleties too. And so I call this the missing in actions.
I love that term. Tell me more.
Yeah. So for me, the missing in actions are, well, number one, women, mm-hmm. and women and girls on the spectrum. But, you know, also African-Americans are, you know, and again, I think it's a good way of thinking about neurodiversity and autism is from a more of a social disability model than it is from a medical or disease model. Mm-hmm. And so the problems of both identification and also incorporation into society are largely socially created. And so, you know, Hans Asperger originally described autism as a variant of male intelligence. Mm-hmm. And we have yet to move off of that. And so women, African-Americans are diagnosed probably 20% less. Other people of color, brown people of color, 60% less. Indigenous people, even more so. Mm-hmm. Lower socioeconomic status, which prevents access to resources, diagnosis, mental health resources, and also rural populations. And missing adults, kids, generations. As you know, you mentioned before we got on, right?
Yeah.
If the kids are right, we're missing all these kids. Where are the kids coming from? Because we know
the stork. They're coming from the stork, right?
<Okay. Yeah. laughs> So yeah. Just magically appearing, like a magic wand. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's coming from somewhere, and so we're also sort of catching up with a lot of missed generations of adults of all shapes and sizes.
Yeah, it's sad in so many ways. It angers me in so many ways, but it also gives me hope because I'm seeing more and more conversations around this. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a few podcasts out there. I just finished the Neurodiverse Love Conference. For any of you that are listening, that access to the 27 presenters is still available. You can go to my website. But what I think is so interesting is you talking about the prevalence rates, because way back when, which isn't that far, 1995, less than 20 years ago, to give that stat that it was 1 in 1,000, if somebody hears that and says, well, why are there more autistic people? That's not what that rate is telling us. What it's telling us is that we have become more aware of various traits of mm-hmm. things that might be happening in a person's life and brain and their thinking and their sensory issues and communication or social challenges. And so, and more people are getting trained and more people are getting educated. And so the prevalence has only changed because we have better ways of identifying neurodiversity, not because we have more autistic people in the world. I mean, we do because they're being identified, but they've always been there. I mean, we know that.
Yeah, this is like a really important distinction because people are going to panic. And this has happened in the past, is that there's an environmental component here. You know, there's vaccines or there's more androgen in the blood in the water system, or, you know, I mean, and I think, you know, number one is we can't really pinpoint that stuff. But what we can say is maybe, you know, autism is sort of catching up to us in a way, you know, and we're finally recognizing that, you know, generations of genetics and genetics would be an interesting way to think about this is the gene, and there's several genes that could have, you know, correlated or connected to autism. Are these have a sort of dominant presentation in the gene pool? And are those things building a little bit, meaning a little bit of spectrum-y stuff with my grandmother, you know, and a mm-hmm. little bit of ADHD with my dad combined. And, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of made me, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a possibility. But yeah, I think that for the most part, this has been here, but just been called by different names.
Yeah.
Been pathologized, villainized, just name it. There's been a lot of stigma around difference, sensitivity, etc.
Yeah. And I mean, it wasn't that long ago that women, as they were going through perimenopause or menopause or maybe after childbirth, they were considered hysterical and they might have been hospitalized. I wonder how many of those women were on the spectrum and the massive changes in their bodies and in their hormones and just in their responsibilities in life may
Oh,
have
yeah.
taken them to a massive autistic burnout. And yet they were hospitalized and it was pathologized. And when you think about so many of the people that have been hospitalized or put through various treatments that are just n no way acceptable in today's day.
Yep.
But how many people suffered unnecessarily because of unidentified autism or unrecognized autism or neurodiversity, right?
Oh my God, yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, this is a big, and this is something I see every day, every week at work. I'm being inundated by people reaching out to me, who like women that have been formally diagnosed with borderline personality disorder or bipolar or have sensory processing stuff or ADHD stuff, and very hard, very difficult time having a sense, getting a sense of who they are and understanding their stuff in a more normalized way that looks at things more of unique wiring and broadens our understanding of what neurodiversity and autism really is. I've got clients who also been diagnosed with dissociative identity disorder, talk about they've been talked about being psychopathic, about being crazy, about so many things, and they come to me and I'm like, whoa, I don't think this is accurate here. So, and I don't even think it's helpful either,
And I think, as people, more and more people contact me after they listen to the podcast, they're like, oh, my gosh, I recognize myself. I recognize my partner. I recognize my mother or my father or my grandparents. And so I think it's really, really important for us on a regular basis to talk about awareness and understanding. So, I know that when I first discovered that my ex might be autistic, and I say this all the time on the podcast, I did not handle it well. He was having a meltdown and we were away for the weekend and I screamed at him, I think you have Asperger's. You need to get assessed. And I screamed it at the top of my lungs. We got into a humongous fight. Neither one of us slept that night. We kind of hated each other in the moment. He called me names. I called him. It wasn't a pleasant thing. And I think if we as a society understood, neurological differences, and we understood neurodiversity, it wouldn't be such a pathologizing experience. It wouldn't be a negative thing to hear that possibly one or both of us is neurodiverse. And so I don't know if you want to speak at all to the awareness and understanding, because you work in a state that probably is not, the most, I want to say this nicely. It's not New York City, right? I mean, Iowa
No.
isn't New York City or LA or
No.
Chicago, right? So the awareness might not be as great as it would be in a big city like those.
Well, yes. I agree with that. And I think, again, we're having to expand greatly, how we think about wiring issues, how it presents in very much more diverse ways than we've thought about in the past. And, part of that process is a lot of my clients that are coming to me with family and couples issues, and they're saying, my daughter or my son, is dyslexic, or I don't know if they're on the spectrum or having behavioral things go on. And then I'm turning to them and say, have you struggled with any of this? And they're like, yeah. And so this is part of the catching up, That's happening all the time for me. And so when people tend to become identified or diagnosed on the spectrum, there's usually like an elevation in the ratcheting up of the stress of life. You know, sometimes that's parenting, sometimes that's a job promotion, sometimes that's a move from middle school to high school to college. But those are when people are coming to me saying, I don't know what's going on, but this is too much, you know, and, you know, help me understand what's going on with me. And a lot of the things that we see every day, like ADHD, OCD, dyslexia, but endemic anxiety and depression are all signs, are all kind of these wayposts that we need to pay attention to a lot more and look into a lot more. And instead of thinking of these clear categories of diagnostic labels, you know, we need to understand that all of these neurological conditions like OCD, ADHD, dyslexia, bipolar, schizoid conditions, synesthesia, sensory processing, seizure conditions. But we also see all these somatic presentations in people with autism. You know, we see issues with food, we see problems with sleep, we see headaches, we see gastrointestinal stuff. All these stuff are like these secondary and tertiary clues that we need to open up to. And so many of my colleagues are saying, hey, I have this client, they have this, and 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 medication doesn't seem to work for them. And I have no clue what's going on.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, hold on a second. You know, there might be one thing here that can explain all of that a lot easier. And so let's broaden the way we think about neurodivergence and autism and take away some of these stigmas too, I think, which is something we maybe will talk about also in the future, which is kind of how we think about the terminology around neurodiversity too.
Yeah. Greg, I think this is so important. And, you know, it's not really something that I've talked in depth about on the podcast. And I've talked about, you know, the differences that a couple might experience in their relationship. But it's like, once you understand that you're wired differently, that you have different ways of doing things that are vitally important in your relationship as a couple, in your family, at work, you know, when it comes to socializing, once you understand that you have very different ways of approaching these things and it continues to create conflict, I think that's when you have the opportunity to bring in a third party or to, you know, start listening to podcasts or read some books. But the understanding is just the beginning, because I can't imagine what it's like, and maybe you want to talk to this. I can't imagine what it's like to go through your entire life and get to the point where you're in your 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. I've even met people in their 70s, and you may have too, who start self-identifying as autistic or get an official diagnosis, and then they have their entire lives that they're looking back and they're trying to make sense of all these things and understand their entire life. And they're also trying to be in a relationship with another human being that they love. Right. So
it gets complicated.
Thoughts on that one? That, you know, the awareness and the understanding are helpful, but then what? Right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and so, you know, it speaks to the importance of not only self-awareness and education, but, you know, even beyond that, you know, I think a lot of one of the deficits we see in autism is struggles with self-identity, also struggles with theory of mind, understanding how you come off, understanding how you're perceived, right? If you already have that stuff going on, it does make it difficult sometimes to come to being identified or diagnosed. And so, you know, and you sort of mentioned some of this too, which is a lot, you know, the idea of narcissism, the problems around empathy, But really, self-awareness and self-understanding is a lifetime of work. And I say for an autistic person, it's probably a lifetime and a half. So, because of some of those deficits around identity and around theory of mind issues. So a lot of my clients are, you wouldn't believe how many of my clients come to me, and I'm working with them in sort of a trauma lens because, but they're autistic, but their parent was a narcissist. Mm-hmm. Or their parent had another personality disorder or had something else, you know? And so again, you know, first we have to, like you said, get there, which is right. Understanding and broadening our ways of understanding and looking at this. And then it's figuring out, well, why? And in that process, there has been a lot of hurt, a lot of damage, and a lot of struggle. Mm-hmm. And so it is difficult to repair and to work through that. But yeah, it starts with opening up to the possibility that you may have unique needs and unique wiring. And it's important that we start reworking and educating ourselves.
Yeah, I think that is really critical. And I want to go back about all the, you kind of give a list of all these things. Mm-hmm. For therapy, and if the therapist little knowledge of neurodiversity, what they're trying to do is into all these boxes in the DSM.
Yeah.
I mean, probably everybody that's listening knows the DSM, but for those folks, the Bible, which I especially around neurodiversity, it's the Bible for, you know, anybody that's in the helping profession who is working on providing a diagnosis to somebody. So I think it's so behind the times when it comes to neurodiversity, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that trying to fit somebody in a box, mm-hmm. when you don't understand how neurological wiring could impact all of those things you talked about. And yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think you really said it beautifully there, that think of this as a Venn diagram instead mm-hmm. of clear categorical labels, you know. And again, there's we need to look at this broad picture of the person's life. You know, we need to look at this broad biopsychosocial sense of what their history had been, how they struggled, and how to incorporate these ideas of social conditioning and of masking and of having to sacrifice your truth, your authenticity for attachment and acceptance, and you know, these things that that make neurodiversity more invisible than it is.
Yeah.
And I'm not into like book banning or book burning, but I might like to slip the DSM into a pile. I hate it. Really do. Everything's categorized as a disorder.
Right.
We know how far behind the DSM has been with every revision and generation. From pathologizing the LGBTQ community and homosexuality and gayness.
Yep.
And how far behind they have been with autism is striking and disturbing, you know, and we're still trying to rework those legacies, you know, and, I really would like the DSM to completely broaden up how we think about these things in a Venn diagram of wiring issues, you know, mm-hmm. and I think that would be really helpful and much more accurate as a way to help us catch up with these, changing ways we understand neurodiversity. And in kids too, I think, you know, the behavior disorders we see diagnosed with kids, you know, oppositional defiant disorder and conduct disorder and ADHD and OCD in kids, these are signs.
You know?
I was a kid who fought I fought, man. That's what I had. If I don't fit in the world and you don't know what else to do,
yeah,
you know, you're gonna act out. And if you also don't have the resources you need,
yeah,
and you don't feel like you fit in, you know, you're gonna have behavioral stuff.
Yeah, I absolutely believe that. A lot of my career I've spent in child welfare and different child welfare agencies or working with them. And we're actually working on a project right now because I believe that this is critical in the child welfare system and probably in the juvenile justice system,
yep,
the homeless system, and the adult criminal justice system. But we're going to start with child welfare. And yep, I'm in Florida, so we're looking at the most high need kids who are in like group home care, mm-hmm, and looking at whether or not they've been assessed for autism, and they haven't, right?
Right.
And so we're linking with the university that has a center for autism and related disabilities to be able to assess these kids, because if you think about it, there's all these kids that are in the foster care system who have all the things you just said, plus yeah, all the issues that we talked about earlier that people like to put them in a box for, and they could all be related to autism. They will never get assessed while they're in the system. They will go on to become, you know, homeless or involved in some mm-hmm other maybe negative behavior or gang or whatever, looking for belonging. They'll never get assessed. They'll never know about autism. And a life that could have been filled with joy and happiness and thriving doesn't become realized. So we're going to be doing this pilot project. So if there's anybody out there in the child welfare field that wants to connect with me, let me know. But can you imagine how many kids are struggling in school? I remember my ex-husband telling me that one day one of his teachers was making fun of him. And I don't know what he was doing because he was very like pedantic in his speaking. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, that probably didn't sit well with a teacher. And his teacher that was making fun of him came by and my ex-husband put his leg out and tripped the teacher. And, you know, he was just so angry, he couldn't hold it in anymore. And I don't know if he had detention or what happened after that. But how many kids are just so frustrated because they're being bullied, they're being yeah ridiculed by their teachers and other students, and even at home because their parents don't realize that yes they are autistic. So it's just a vicious cycle. So clearly, there's more we can do about awareness and understanding. We can do more to update, not you and I, Greg, but society, to update DSM.
Yes.
The DSM. Let's talk a little bit about recognizing and normalizing autism. And I want to start with within families, okay? Because this has become a really, really big issue. And I hear it from a lot of folks who come to the support groups I facilitate that they may find out that one partner may find out that they're autistic. They may self-identify or go on for a formal evaluation. And they are literally afraid to tell anybody,
yeah,
anybody.
Yeah.
And so they've begun to recognize why they have had the challenges in their family or in their relationship, but mm-hmm then they're not able to communicate maybe outside of the relationship with their partner. They're even afraid to tell their children.
Yeah.
So any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I deal with a lot of couples, a lot of families, but a lot of single people on the spectrum that obviously we talk about those family issues, you know. And one person I just talked with said, you know, I am really struggling. And I think she's maybe in her 20s or something at this point. I was diagnosed as autistic as a kid, but my mom didn't like it. So we kind of shut that down.
Oh, wow.
We kind of shut that down. And so she's reached out to me saying, I need someone to talk to about what's going on for me. And I need to know, what is this? And, you know, who am I? And so think about the damage has been done. And what's funny, what she told me when I talked with her is that I've come back and I talked to my mom about those times when I was a kid. And that now I think I really am on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And the mom is like, well, you know, I think I'm on the spectrum too. And I didn't want to see it. Right?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Did not want to see it. And also, you don't want that for your kid.
Yeah.
And so it's very hard for people to get there. And the word autism, which I'm all for using more, you know,
yeah.
Even Asperger's, I'm like Aspie, you know, I'm like, let's use these terms. Let's try to reclaim, their stigma in more normal ways. And let's also find new ways of talking about them, new ways of finding our identity and declaring it. But there is so much baggage in terms of what people have gone through, what you want for your kids, and those, you know, overlapping and competing agendas and needs and hurt and wounds that really create so many barriers for even just self-disclosure, mm-hmm. you know, even yeah. accepting what it is, you know. And I have people that I know are autistic, and their kid has been diagnosed autistic, and they know their mom is autistic, but they aren't. I'm like, okay. You know.
Yeah, I know. And so here's the thing. And again, we can't do this in a podcast, and we can't do it just between you and I, but mm-hmm. we can start. I mean, I have started the conversation with the podcast. I think recognizing that everybody's brain is wired differently is really, really important, right?
Yep.
And then normalizing that because we all have different brains, and my ex used to say this to me, when I would say to him, well, now I know that our brains are wired differently. He's like, everybody's brain's wired differently. I said, I know, but now I understand that because our brains are wired differently, we had conflict that if we had known how different we were and that we needed different ways of communicating, or, you know, you needed yep. more downtime and I needed more socializing time, or mm-hmm. I wasn't going to get a smile out of you when I was really excited about something and, you know, smiling from ear to ear, and you were just saying, yeah, that's good. I wanted you to get really excited with me, and I took it personally. So yeah. All those things, yes, everybody's brain is wired differently, but recognizing in the ways that it is different within a couple and within a family and even a work environment or wherever else you're around people is yes. going to be critical for normalizing the differences.
Exactly. I think this is really hard, you know, in a lot of ways. And I'll kind of explain why from an autistic perspective. But, you know, I think it's really insightful, the example you gave, which is there could be a normalization where we say, yeah, everybody is a different neurotype and everybody processes and does things differently. Therefore, there's nothing there, right? And so mm-hmm. it dissolves on its own, right? And so this is something we can't quite let happen, you know. As much as we're broadening and in thinking about these things in more open ways, it doesn't dissolve the fact that there's stuff and there's specific stuff going on, and there's a lens from which we can understand and grow and develop a better sense of who we need to be in the world, and also how society can help normalize and create space for those differences and those sensitivities. But from an autistic perspective, and I've even talked to you about this myself, which is I haven't revealed a lot of it to my family, because every time I have, they've said, no, you're not. And you don't really look autistic. And, mm-hmm. you know, and then suddenly I'm like, okay, now do I have to go over my whole life and tell them what my internal experience was? Right. And then connect it to all of those autistic traits so they can make sense of it. And of course, I don't really want to have to do that work.
Right.
The other part of that is that as soon as you did say that, not only were you dismissed, but also there is that negative stigma around it, you know, what I call Devon Price says in his book Unmasking Autism calls quote unquote, the assholery of the stereotype of the autistic person, you know, mm-hmm. which is this rude, blunt, you know, and man, I had that stuff going on, you know, so I'm not denying that wasn't there. In fact, my mother-in-law said to me when I disclosed to her, she said, "Oh, okay. Well, I just thought you had to have everything your way."
The control issues, right? That was my father. Right? That yep. was absolutely my father. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And so there's a risk of disclosure, and there's also the risk of it being perceived as this trump card, you know, mm-hmm. that here I'm holding up this thing and now you have to accommodate me, or at the workplace, here's the threat of the lawsuit, you know? And so there's a lot of discomfort around this. And so again, this discussion around the normalization of our differences in needs and sensitivities and processing styles is so important, you know, and it's going to take some time.
Yeah. And it may not be in our lifetime. I mean, we're not that far in age from each other, but mm-hmm. I'm 59. Will I see the kind of changes that I would love to see by the time I leave this earth? Maybe, because we do have social media. We do have so many young people that are taking to social media and explaining mm-hmm. their lived experiences and, you know, advocating for change. I think what you said is so important. Regarding your mother-in-law and other people in your family, because when I first started this work, my ex-husband was 100% supportive. And then a family member, actually several family members, got very upset at me and said that, you know, he was not on the spectrum. Even though he had said to me numerous times, like lots and lots of times, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he used to ask me, is mm-hmm. this Asperger's? Is this autism? Whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't matter to me whether he, you know, self-identified or had a formal evaluation. I just began to understand why we had the difficulties we had. And I think, and I've said this before on the podcast, but I think it bears repeating, nobody knew him the way I knew him.
Oh, yeah.
Because I lived with him for 30 years under the same roof. We lived together for a year before we got married. So we lived together under the same roof for about 30 years. Nobody else saw what I saw. And because so many autistic people don't even realize they're masking or camouflaging, they're presenting a whole different persona oftentimes to the people they work with, to their family, maybe even to their children. And I really do believe, and I feel this is going to be validating to some folks, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, there is nobody who is going to know you or your partner, you know, the way you know each other.
Yeah.
And I feel it's a struggle for family members to fully understand that there may be a completely different person living in this intimate relationship than the one they know and see. And that's what I experienced. So I don't know if that resonates with you at all, or, you know, just based on what you had said earlier.
Yeah, I mean, it does resonate with me. And part of what happens, right, from the not just experience perspective is you are out in the world. Here's something that just take a step back about.
Okay.
The internal autistic experience is one of high intensity of working extremely hard internally. A lot of times people don't know that, not only from the outside, but even the autistic person doesn't, because that's been their experience from day one. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, is how do I navigate this moment that I don't understand, or that's overwhelming for me, or that's too much, or I can't navigate. And so part of that is, you know, what you do out into the world, you know, in order to, again, appear, you know, normal, quote unquote, or to find acceptance or to fit in ways. And that takes a lot of internal effort. When you come home And this is where a lot of my clients have the difficulty. They can do their job. You know, sometimes they don't work a good 40-hour week very well, but they can do their job. But right. then coming home
yeah.
and still working that hard, either as a parent or in the relationship or with the housework or the responsibilities that don't stop, yeah. that's the thing that becomes the thing that overfloods the person. And then that's when you're going to see some more of those traits, which maybe aren't so pretty, which really speak to, again, some of the things that in terms of how I describe the autistic experience in terms of these barriers between internal, external world, capacity issues, and stuckness.
Yeah, I think what you just said is so powerful. And you described it, I think, as overlapping traits with different things. Like you talked about, you've even said that you might have been called the narcissist, you know, mm-hmm. having control issues. But this yep. goes back to the understanding. If we understand we're in a neurodiverse relationship, neurodiverse family, we have neurodiverse colleagues,
yep.
then when somebody appears to be controlling or appears to be right. narcissistic, we can, and I had many employees, once I learned about neurodiversity, I saw many of my employees were autistic and ADHD, mm-hmm. yep. and I communicated with them so differently. So when they were in the process of having a meltdown and calling me names, literally calling me names in front of other people at a meeting, mm-hmm. I would say, you know, let's excuse ourselves. And, you know, we can reconvene this conversation at a later time. Why don't you go for a walk, go for a ride, go get yourself a nice tea, whatever. And I understood that it wasn't their regulated person self, you know, having these meltdowns. It was this dysregulated, very stressed person who was trying to control their environment or keep things out that were going to make things even worse. Yep. But, you know, I'll tell you, Greg, if I hadn't known that, they would have been fired on the spot.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yep, exactly. So, you know, stress and capacity issues are really an important thing to be aware of. And, you know, luckily I have, you know, both a therapist and a mentor that's helping me all the time, which is really important. And one of the things that we've noticed is when my stress goes up, or what I call my trying too hard parts get activated, because mm-hmm. again, that's, and I've yet to find an autistic person doesn't have that, you know?
Yeah.
When that goes up, that's when all of my skills socially and my flexibility and my empathy go down. So that takes up too much room in me. And suddenly, you know, my mentor is saying, Greg, you're getting rigid about stuff. You know, you're not as open to what I'm talking about for some reason. What's going on? Right. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I am really trying hard. And, you know, I'm able to, you know, shift towards self-compassion and to understanding of what's happening instead of just being in it. And so, and that really speaks to, again, these issues, again, to me, which are the big three internal issues with autism, which is capacity issues, barriers between your internal, external worlds, and also behavior around stuckness, resolution, yada, yada, yada. So those things, if we create awareness around them, we can understand, you know, why someone's behavior gets so maybe reactive or looks more controlling or looks more narcissistic. And we have a lens from which to understand that rather than just thinking of them as a bad person, right? They're struggling. They're yeah. trying harder. The internal experience of the autistic person is one of intense effort internally.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I saw this with my ex. I mean, you know, gastrointestinal issues, you mm-hmm. know, just various things. And I see this with friends who are autistic. And one of the guys I dated who he kept asking me, do you think I'm autistic? I'm like, yeah, I know you are now. a high functioning alcoholic. with serious narcissistic and control issues. Mm-hmm. Again, in an attempt to make sure that he could stay as regulated as possible. But I think just having this discussion on the podcast is going to be so helpful to so many folks. And I think there are also going to be folks out there, because we talked about this a little bit, you know, folks who don't have the privilege of having a mentor and a therapist or a partner who understands neurodiversity, understands autism, and is going to be looking at these traits that might seem negative on the outside, but are more, you know, defense mechanisms or coping mechanisms to help you stay regulated. You know, because not everybody has those resources available to them, maybe you can share, you know, what do you do when, you know, you see that you're in that control state or more that narcissistic state? Are there, you know, one or two things that you can share with the listeners that might be helpful?
Absolutely. So my big philosophy, and I may have mentioned this already, is the relationship with yourself is the most important thing. And it is the thing that determines everything else. Okay. So where it's very easy to get caught up in what I would call maybe protective parts or adaptations or reactivity. And all those things are trying to protect you from overwhelm, from wounds, from being hurt again, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We oftentimes become somewhat unconscious and we externalize, meaning we react out of them. Yep. or from them, instead of responding with them. And my philosophy is always working with and also understanding healthy internalization. And internalization, we think you don't want to internalize stuff. You're going to hold things in and you're going to get stuck inside your head. And I'm like, no, you don't want to externalize stuff, but you want to have a really healthy relationship and understanding of yourself, because you need to care for yourself in that moment.
Yep.
And it's not about trying to fix it on the outside. It's not trying to get somebody else to fix it for you. It's not to make society accommodate you in that moment. It's about you're struggling, you need, and are you going to meet yourself with real deep understanding, validation, care, and compassion, or not? Yeah. You know, and the relationship with the self is all predicated on how we relate to those difficult parts of ourselves, those parts of ourselves that we don't like, that are uncomfortable, that are annoying, that are frustrating, that, again, gets us in those reactive and externalizing patterns. So to me, it's healthy internalization and the relationship with the self over externalization. And that's something I shift my clients with every single day, it seems like.
That is so powerful. And I'm actually reading a book. I don't know if you've seen this book. It's Anxiety RX. And I highly recommend it to any of our listeners. It's by Dr. Russell Kennedy. And some of what he talks about is very reminiscent of internal family systems, which I know is your, you know, kind of main therapeutic model that you use, and I absolutely love it. And I know now there was a book recently that was published on internal family systems and somatic experiences and somatic therapy.
Yep.
And I love what you just said, because what you're sharing with the audience is that this is an internal process. Mm-hmm. This is about you changing you. It's not about relying on your partner changing, which I'm raising both hands, Greg. I was guilty of thinking if my ex-husband would just stop being so negative, if my ex-husband would be more emotional in a positive way, if my ex-husband would just, you know, process his day when he gets home from work, if my ex-husband would travel with me more and be relaxed and not sleep till 4 o'clock in the afternoon when we travel, you know, it was all about changing him.
Yes.
And that was wrong. And, you know, right? I probably knew it in my heart and soul, but I was working on changing myself towards the end of our marriage. But during our separation, when I found out that we were a neurodiverse couple, I realized, and I've said this before over and over again, and I'm going to use a bad word, I fucked up royally. I screwed up. Okay. Yeah. I did things that were definitely setting my ex off, but gosh, did I dysregulate myself?
Yes.
And that's what I had to own, Greg. It wasn't about my ex's actions. It wasn't about his behavior. It wasn't about how different, and this is just me. This is the epiphany I had. I don't remember how many years ago. It wasn't about all the external things that I was upset about and I felt were triggering me. It was about my response, not reaction, response.
Exactly.
It was about me grounding myself. It was about me understanding what I needed that was healthy.
Yes.
A bottle or two of wine is not healthy. Or eating an entire bag of potato chips is not healthy. You know, when I figured that stuff out, then when I am triggered by something outside of me, And I've said this before, it takes me 30 seconds, a minute, maybe 2 minutes to get re-regulated and calm.
Yes. Yeah. What you described there, I think, is just so insightful and so spot on, you know, because, you know, you were disempowering yourself.
Yes.
You know,
100%.
You were saying, you determine my happiness. Someone else gets to determine whether I am fulfilled and how I can be happy in this world. Right. Instead of, like you said, having ownership of your needs, honoring your needs, understanding what you can't control, what you can let go of, what, you know, and how to come back to yourself. And I think that's the other thing that I work a lot on with my clients, because yet to have an autistic client that doesn't have trauma, and we can talk about trauma for years.
Yeah.
But at some point, I'm going to shift them to say, what about you? What right. about the fact that you just didn't get your needs met? Isn't this a little bit more of an empowering lens for us to create a little bit of a shift to? Because I'll validate your trauma all day long, but it's not about what happened to you. It's what happened inside of you. And this is where we need to work, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And the more we can understand that, and that's what I love about the season 5 that I'm doing with you and other co-hosts who have different perspectives on this. We can complain. We can talk about what went wrong. We can, you know, pathologize. We can do whatever we want to do in relation to neurodiversity or, you know, the bad ex or whatever. That isn't going to help you heal, and it isn't going to give you the coping skills you need to be thriving, not just surviving, that's but right. thriving in this world. And so I'd love to end the conversation by talking a little bit about the generation gap, because I think this is going to become hopefully smaller as the years go on. But I do think that there are a lot of folks that have been struggling their entire life. They will never admit that they're neurodiverse or autistic. They will continue to struggle. They will continue to look outside of them. And my father was one of them. He died in 2005, but we used to go to restaurants and he used to bitch at the waiter or waitress.
Mm, yep.
He used to call them names when they walked away. He used to scream at them. And I learned that from him. It didn't feel great for me you know, some of that stuff. But I learned it. I watched him do it, and I watched it kind of be effective, you know, for a man to have that kind of power and whatever. But it didn't feel good to me. It always kind of stuck in my stomach watching him do it. And then when I would get dysregulated in doing it. But we can know that our parent or parents are or were neurodiverse. We can know that our children are. We can accept that within ourselves. But having the conversation and being comfortable having or recognizing certain traits, I think that generation gap is going to be a challenge for a while. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
I agree. I think it will be a challenge. I think there are ways of working around it or getting people there, but it does take time. It does take patience. It also takes a lot of shifting in terms of those tools, you know. So if we can validate and create compassion around how people struggle, and like you said, normalize and humanize this, you know, those are our ways in.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, again, labels, the undiagnosed autism does not look great in a lot of ways, because you have to double down on your needs and on your disconnection with the world and an attempt to, you know, navigate and bridge those things. And a lot that isn't all that pretty as it relates to the people around you or your job or how you react to things. And, you know, I can even look at my own parents who, you know, my dad was first a music teacher, which is not that surprising. And then a child psychologist, which is more surprising, not so much as I see it now, because I'm also sort of a psychologist now. But he knew everything about child development, but could not emotionally connect to his kids.
Oh my gosh, Greg, my dad started as a child psychologist too.
Oh my gosh, yep.
I didn't know that about your dad. So interesting. Yeah, he started as a child psychologist. He started in the school system, lasted for 2 years because he burned every single bridge. Yeah. He couldn't, he had to do 2 years there to get his supervision, to get his license, because he had a PhD. He got his license and he ran, but they would not, my mother also was a psychologist, they would not hire my mother because they had the same last name, because they did not want to be associated with another person in our family. And she had to threaten him with divorce. He had to go in and apologize to the head of the school psychology. I mean, it was a mess, but now I understand, you know, he had undiagnosed autism.
Yeah, it's same with my dad, you know, and he was also, it turns out, a closeted gay man. He had two boys and did not have good interception or coordination or awareness of his body. And he was terrified of showing us that.
Wow. Yeah.
So we have to think about how, again, we've stigmatized so much difference. And this goes to gender identity and social conditioning and all kinds of all more stuff, but there's so much baggage here we have to undo. And from the previous generations, there's much more entrenchment in that, you know, and I think that this is going to come from more of a bottom up or a young people up sort of process, right? Which again is, you know, sometimes parents recognizing their traits in their kid. That was how I got to it, you know, where, you know, my son was clearly on the spectrum and I just said, hey guys, we know this is a genetic thing. Who'd you get it from? And they're like, duh, dad, you. Yeah, pick a parent. And they're like, duh, dad, you, you know, and and I'm like, ah, yeah. Okay, I get that. Okay, you know, so it took me a while to get there too, you know. I'm proud that I have, but again, all that doubling down, all that rigidity, all the social conditioning, there are so many things to work through to open up, to normalize, and to heal through this issue.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a great note to end on and to say to those folks that are listening, because we're going to get deep into some issues in this season. Nothing's off the table. I think the self-awareness and knowing how to regulate yourself and really being aware of what's going on in your body, your parts, as you talked about, you know, watch some videos on IFS, find an IFS and internal family systems therapist, because those parts and those coping mechanisms or defense mechanisms that have gotten you as far as they've gotten you in your life are there because there's some wounding. There's some, you know, inner child wounding or healing that needs to go on. And if you don't do it by yourself or you feel you can't, I think it's going to be really, really important to find the right therapist who not only has skills in this area, but also really, really understands neurodiversity.
Yep.
Because I see my father did harm to my sister and I. Not intentionally.
Yeah, right.
Because he kept trying to control his environment.
Yep.
And so, you know, I see so many families where they have very little contact with one parent or grandparent because they're probably on the spectrum.
Yep.
And they don't have that self-awareness, and they don't know how to communicate with their parent or grandparent. And It just causes so much pain, right? So much pain.
So true.
Yeah. So Greg, I know as we continue our conversations on the podcast, there are going to be people that are going to want to reach out to you. So what is the best place for people to contact you? And I'll put that in the show notes.
Well, you can contact me through a few different means. You know, I do have a website, gregfuqua.com. And I also work at an agency in Central Iowa called LifeWorks, LifeWorks DM, which is Des Moines, LifeWorksDM.com. And also, you can also look me up on Psychology Today, where I have a apparently very popular profile. So either of those methods will get you all to the same place, and love to hear from you.
Fantastic. All right, great. And listeners, if you have any questions or topics you'd like Greg and I to address, feel free to drop me a DM on Instagram at neurodiverse_love, or you can send me an email at neurodiverselove, the number 4, letter U, at gmail.com. Greg, I look forward to our future episodes and to having more amazing conversations. Thank you so much for being my guest co-host.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure, Mona. Thank you so much for having me. Wonderful conversation. Thanks so much for what you're doing.